the various elements that I mentioned in my statement, both the national level legislation, the way Parliament works, because there was a lot of cross-block horse trading going on, particularly for that February package that had gives and takes from all of the political groups, which, of course, in many respects are sectarian organized. That process, I find, is as encouraging as the result. So, yes, I think they're moving in the right direction, but, yes, I also believe they've got an awful lot more in front of them.
I look forward to this afternoon. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Graham.
That was
thank you.
That was Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, a Democrat. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News of General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker's testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. The senator asking questions now is Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina.
There's the go, so I'd send you to a good place. Ambassador Crocker, I cannot tell you how proud I am of both of you. And let's start this with kind of a 30,000-foot assessment. The surge, General Petraeus, was a corrective action. Is that fair to say?
That's correct, Senator.
The reason it was a corrective action is between the fall of Baghdad in January 2007, all of the trend lines were going in the wrong way. Economic stagnation, political stagnation, increased proliferation of violence. Therefore, something had to be done. And that something was called the surge. Now, I would just ask the American people and my colleagues to evaluate fairly from January 2007 to July 2008 and see what's happened. The challenges are real, but there are things that have happened in that moment and in that period of time that need to be understood as being beneficial to this country, that came at a heavy price. And Al-Qaeda cannot stand the surge. If you put a list of people who wanted us to leave, the number one group would be Al-Qaeda because you've been kicking them all over Iraq. Now, the reason they came to Iraq is why, General Petraeus?
That Al-Qaeda came to Iraq, sir?
Yes.
To establish a base in the heart of the Arab world, in the heart of the Mideast.
Are they closer to their goal after the surge or further away?
Further away, Senator.
Okay. What's the busy, if you had to pick one thing to tell the American people that was the biggest success of the surge, what would it be?
Probably Anbar province and or just the general progress against Al-Qaeda.
Would it be the fact that Muslims tasted Al-Qaeda life in Iraq and Iraqi Muslims joined with us to fight Al-Qaeda?
I think the shift in Sunni Arabs against Al-Qaeda has been very, very significant. The rejection of the indiscriminate violence, the extremist ideology, and really even the oppressive practices associated with Al-Qaeda is, again, very, very significant change.
Is it fair to say that when Muslims will stand by us and fight against bin Laden, his agents and sympathizers, we're safer?
Absolutely.
Ambassador Crocker, what is Iran up to in Iraq?
Senator, I described what I believe to be an effort at Lebanization through the backing of different militia groups.
Okay, let's stop there. Lebanon kicked Syria out a few years ago, and they tried to create a democracy, some form of democracy. Hezbollah, backed by Iran, had a say in that endeavor. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
And they launched an attack from Lebanon against Israel at the time the United Nations was about to sanction Iran for their nuclear endeavors. Is that correct?
I believe so, sir.
So is it fair to say that from an Iranian point of view, one of their biggest nightmares would be a functioning democracy in Lebanon, a functioning representative government in Iraq on their borders?
Certainly their behavior would indicate that that may be the case. You make an important point because we look at Iraq as a nation in its own terms. The region looks at it a little bit differently. Iran and Syria have been cooperating over Lebanon since the early 1980s. Over a quarter of a century, they have worked together against the Lebanese and against our interests. They're using that same partnership in Iraq, in my view, although the weights are reversed, with Iran having the greater weight and Syria the lesser. But they are working in tandem together against us and against a stable Iraqi state.
If I can walk through what these laws mean to me, and this is just my opinion. Provincial elections in October are important to me because it means that the Sunnis understand that participating in representative government seems to be in their interest. Therefore, they're going to vote in October of 2008, and they boycotted in 05. Is that correct?
That's one of the reasons they're important, yes.
Okay, so the Sunnis are going to come out and by the millions, we anticipate to send representatives to Baghdad or to the provinces rather than sending bombs. Is that correct?
That is what I would expect, yes.
Okay, now the reason the surge has been successful to me, General Petraeus, is that the Anbar province has been liberated from al-Qaeda, but we've had a reduction in sectarian violence. Is that true?
That is true.
Okay, now this breathing space that we've been urging to have happen by better security, from my opinion, has produced economic results not known before January 2007. Is that correct? The economy is improving.
That is correct.
The Iraqis will be paying more over time to bear the burden of fighting for their freedom.
That's correct.
They will be fighting more to bear the burden of their freedom. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is there any way Iraq could be a failed state and it not affect our national security?
No, sir.
What would happen if the policy of the United States began January 2007 to remove a brigade a month in Baghdad, of Iraq? What would be the military consequences to such an endeavor, in your opinion? If we announced as a nation we're going to withdraw a brigade out of Iraq every month?
Sir, it clearly would depend on the conditions at that time. If the conditions were good and quite good, then that might be doable.
At this point in time, does that seem to be a responsible position to take, given what you know about Iraq, to make that announcement now?
Well, Senator, again, I have advocated conditions-based reductions, not a timetable. War is not a linear phenomenon. It's a calculus, not arithmetic, and that is why, again, I have recommended conditions-based reductions following the completion of the surge forces drawn down.
Senator Graham, thank you. Senator Ben Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Petraeus, Ambassador Crocker. First,
that was Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a Republican, and now we have Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska.
In Iraq and elsewhere around the world. I might add that as a proud Nebraskan, a proud American, I witnessed on one of the national news channels an American, Captain Logan Veith, embedded with the Iraqi army in Sadr City, leading forth a challenge and doing a remarkable job. We're all proud of him and those who he represents as well. In 2003, as Senator Collins mentioned, Senator Bayh and I and others introduced legislation to require that at least part of the money that was going for reconstruction in that supplemental be considered a loan forgivable to a grant, part of it a loan, but part of it also a loan to be forgivable to a grant if the rest of the countries would forgive the IOUs of Iraq that they held. The administration blocked it, even though it passed the Senate, because they said that they were going to the donors' conference and this would impair their ability to get the other countries as part of the coalition to be donors. Well, it turned out to be a lenders' conference in general because the others did loan the money. Now we have an opportunity to go back and look at what Secretary Wolfowitz said in 2003. Said we really ought to be able to get our money back from Iraq because they're through their oil revenues, they're going to be able to pay for the war themselves, finance it themselves. That was in reconstruction, not the war, but the reconstruction. Comment, Ambassador Crocker, that they're in a position soon or something to be able to take on that responsibility. Soon to me means now. What I think we should do is in this supplemental, and I'll introduce legislation with others to be able to do this, to make any further reconstruction money a loan. purely and simply to be repaid, not forgiven. And any other money that has been appropriated but unspent to date, alone as well. When Iraq is today on the basis of the $111 barrel oil and $3.25 and upwards gas at the pump here in the United States, it just does not seem responsible for us to continue to borrow from our grandchildren in China and other places around the world to be able to finance, in effect, what is their future opportunity. It seems to me that now is the time. You also, Ambassador Crocker, said that you think that they should be doing this soon. Will there be a change in the thinking of the administration on this? Will they now support legislation that could be worked out to make that now, make soon now, and into the future on this on these future appropriations and past appropriations that are unspent?
Senator, there is very much an interest in moving the financing from us to the Iraqis.
Well, I think you're answering my question, but, you know, there was an interest back in 2003 when Secretary Wolfowitz said that they ought to be able to finance their own reconstruction. I'm trying to figure out whether soon can be now.
Senator, with respect to reconstruction, soon basically is now. We are...
In terms of a loan?
In terms of the United States no longer being involved in the physical reconstruction business.
What about the money that's in the current supplemental that is there for reconstruction? Is that structured as a loan?
Sir, that is not... In my definition, it is not for reconstruction. These are for example, some USAID programs that we think are very important to stabilization in conjunction with the military's SERP spending. We will move into immediate post-kinetic situations and get people going with jobs and things like that.
Well, then let's call it post-kinetic aid as well. It seems to me that if we're paying for what is not, let's say, military hardware, because they're picking up more of the costs, we ought to be looking at training costs that we're engaged in. I just think that there's a point in time, and it's now, when we need to find a way to make sure that Iraq is financing more of its own present and future rather than incurring those costs ourselves by when they're adding $50 to $60 billion to surplus at a time when we're developing hundreds of billions of dollars of deficit. It just doesn't make sense for us to be the financier of first resort.
Sir, I'm committed to that. At the same time, I don't think you have a one-size-fits-all situation here. A number of our programs, particularly those that get down to the local level, that our PRTs, for example, identify and execute, the Iraqi government is really not going to be positioned to pick that up or even identify it.
Well, I don't care whether they can do that. We can pay it, but whether they can get the money out of their treasury or not is secondary. If we can do it, we should do it. And then they should repay us. And what about the money that's already been appropriated but unspent? Will that now not be spent?
Again, if you're talking about reconstruction. You know, we're down to like the last 2 or 3% of the IRRF projects. These are things that are underway that we're going to be bringing to completion.
Well, I think there are billions and billions of dollars that would fall into that category, and for me, $1 billion is not pencil dust.
I understand the point, Senator. At the same time, again, these are projects that are underway. I think we'd have to think very carefully if we want to risk a halt in ongoing completion while we try and negotiate with the Iraqis on...
Well, I think that's all well and good, but I wish we'd have thought more carefully earlier and got this set, such as back in 2003. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Thune.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next questioner is Republican John Thune of South Dakota.
Service to our country, and thank you for your very candid assessment of how things are going. As always, you've been very forthright in your testimony, and we appreciate that because I think it's important that we have a good understanding of conditions as you understand them to be on the ground. And we make decisions on funding both on the military level and the other benchmarks that we're trying to achieve with regard to economic and political progress in the region. I'm wondering if you might be able to elaborate a little bit on the whole issue of the Shia militias and the Iranian influence there. Seems to me, at least, that a lot of our success these past several months has been the ceasefire that the Mahdi army has observed. And my question, I guess, gets at the point of whether or not Sadr really is in control, or whether the Iranians are pulling the strings there. And if we're going to continue to see reduction in violence and a lessening of American casualties and civilian casualties there, that's going to be a big factor. And I guess I'd be interested in knowing, General, what your impressions are about who really is in charge of these Shia militias and the Mahdi army. Is it Sadr or is it the Iranians?
Well, Senator, let's go back to when the original ceasefire was put in place in August, and that was directed by Muqtada al-Sadr. And it was because of violence that was precipitated in the holy city of Karbala by militia elements that refused to surrender their weapons before going into the shrine area. That was did a great deal of damage to the reputation of the overall Sadr movement, which, again, is first and foremost a political movement. And then also has the associated militia. Added to that over time were connections between the militia and or the special groups, which are, again, these elements that are affiliated with or associated with the Sadr militia but have been selected carefully and then typically are paid for, trained by, and armed by Iran, by the Quds Force in particular, and which do take direction from the Quds Force. The hand of Iran was very clear in recent weeks. And again, there was a recognition, we think, in Iran, based on people who talked to some of the leaders there, that, in fact, what was transpiring was very damaging to not just to Iraq, not just in the violence to the Iraqi people, but not just to the reputation of the militia, but also was backfiring on Iran itself. And in fact, I think it's arguably it did generate a unification in concern among Iraqi political leaders about Iranian activity in Iraq that was nowhere near as great, I would argue, just a month or so ago. As we mentioned earlier, both of us have said that it sort of brought out in higher relief the activities of Iran, of the Quds Force in particular, and its involvement with these special groups and with the weapons and training that they provided to them.
Let me ask you, General, there have been some here who have talked about putting restrictions on or limiting funding for the Commander's Emergency Response Program. Could you describe that program and its value to commanders in the field?
Well, Senator, as you know, a number of us at different times have stated that there's a point in operations where money becomes your most important ammunition. And typically it's small amounts of money at local levels where when you have all of a sudden the opportunity, because of security improvements, you can very rapidly commit it, again, in small amounts. We have also used it to fund the so-called Sons of Iraq. And as I had on the one of the charts, I think it's about $16 million a month is the payroll for those individuals on average. And I can tell you that the savings that we have had in vehicles not lost in areas where they used to be lost. There's an area south of Baghdad, southwest, that used to be called the Triangle of Death. That area has actually been very, very quiet over the course of the last 6 months since our forces and Iraqi forces cleared of al-Qaeda. And then Sons of Iraq stood up to help secure local communities. It's a big reason why we have the enormous numbers of caches being found. Most of them are being identified by, again, these local individuals or by local citizens who have benefited from various projects done by the SERP program, have seen, therefore, the benefits, improved security, and started to see some economic growth. And oftentimes, the pump is primed with small amounts of SERP very early in that process before the Iraqi government can reconnect to these communities, get the different ministry activities out there helping them. It, by the way, I might add, again, this is the reason that Iraq has committed some of its money, $300 million as its initial amount, to fund something called Iraqi SERP, which will help enormously and can greatly expand the impact of the overall program. Again, we have a capacity out there in a lot of these communities, particularly ones that over the course of the last year were recently cleared of Al-Qaeda or other extremists. We have an ability to spend that money that they do not. And again, they are now very much our partners in that and very much doing a cost-sharing approach and beyond over time.
Last week, the Readiness and Management Subcommittee received testimony from the service vice chiefs on the current readiness of the forces, and they all testified that military units that are deploying to you in theater are currently adequately trained, equipped, and ready to carry out the missions that you've assigned. As the combatant commander, is that your perception as well?
Senator, I would say that this is the best Army that I've ever seen in 34 years of service. Now, it is an Army that is capable of what we might call full spectrum. In fact, what our doctrine does call full spectrum operations. Counterinsurgency operations include not just the stability and support ops, but also offense and defense. We have in the last year, for example, done major operations in places like Ramadi, Bakuba, South Baghdad, and a variety of other locations that have involved all of our different capabilities in the military, not just the soft side, again, of stability and support operations. I've said on a number of occasions that there were two enormous changes that I found when I came back to Iraq, or went, got back to Iraq in January 2007. The first was the damage done by sectarian violence, which tore the fabric of society. The second was how much our leaders get it about what it is that we're trying to do over there as a result of all the changes made by the services in terms of doctrine, education, preparation of units, and so forth. So the units are exceedingly well-trained. They are the best equipped. When I look back at the fact that as a division commander, when we crossed the berm and went into Iraq, we had one unmanned aerial vehicle that we were all fighting over within the entire Corps, and now look at the enormous proliferation of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms, at the enormous tools that the different intelligence agencies have now provided to us, the fusion of intelligence and the way that special forces, special mission elements, and conventional forces all work together and literally have fusion cells, the proliferation of real-time situational awareness tools, just on and on and on, satellite tracking and communications. We are vastly better than where we were in 2003 when we went through the berm, and again, especially in terms of so-called full-spectrum operations, which is what most of us think we'll be involved in the future, that there are not too many peer competitors, as they say, out there that want to take us on toe-to-toe out in the desert somewhere in open tank warfare.
Thank you all again very much for your service to our country, and please convey to those who serve under your command our deep appreciation for their service and sacrifice as well.
I will, Senator, if I could just thank the committee for one thing in particular, and that is the MRAP vehicles, the mine-resistant ambush protected. These have been lifesavers, and countless soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines have been saved by these vehicles and by the additional protection that they provide to the occupants.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for that, General. Thank you, Senator Thune and Senator Clinton.
Senator John Thune of South Dakota, and the next questioner is Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York.
Crocker, for your long and distinguished service to our nation. Before I ask you any questions, I just want to respond to some of the statements and suggestions that have been made leading up to this hearing and even during it, that it is irresponsible or demonstrates a lack of leadership to advocate withdrawing troops from Iraq in a responsible and carefully planned withdrawal. I fundamentally disagree. Rather, I think it could be fair to say that it might well be irresponsible to continue the policy that has not produced the results that have been promised time and time again at such tremendous cost to our national security and to the men and women who wear the uniform of the United States military. Our troops are the best in the world, and they have performed admirably and heroically in Iraq. However, the purpose of the surge, let's not forget, as described by the Bush administration, was to create the space for the Iraqis to engage in reconciliation and make significant political progress. However, since General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker last testified in September, even General Petraeus, as recently as 3.5 weeks ago, has acknowledged that the Iraqi government has not made sufficient political progress. And our current strategy in Iraq has very real costs. We rarely talk about the opportunity costs, the opportunities lost because of the continuation of this strategy. The longer we stay in Iraq, the more we divert resources, not only from Afghanistan, but other international challenges as well. In fact, Admiral Mullen last week said that the military would have already assigned forces to missions elsewhere in the world were it not for what he called the pressure that's on our forces right now. And he admitted that force levels in Iraq right now do not allow us to have the force levels we need in Afghanistan. The Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, General Cody, testified last week that the current demands for forces in Iraq and Afghanistan limits our ability to provide ready forces for other contingencies. And finally, the cost to our men and women in uniform is growing. Last week, the New York Times noted the stress on the mental health of our returning soldiers and Marines from multiple and extended deployments. Among combat troops sent to Iraq for the third or fourth time, more than 1 in 4 show signs of anxiety, depression, or acute stress, according to an official Army survey of soldiers' mental health. The administration and supporters of the administration's policy often talk about the cost of leaving Iraq, yet ignore the greater costs of continuing the same failed policy. You know, the lack of political progress over the last 6 months and the recent conflict in Basra reflect how tenuous the situation in Iraq really is. And for the past 5 years, we have continually heard from the administration that things are getting better, that we're about to turn a corner, that there is finally a resolution in sight. Yet each time, Iraqi leaders fail to deliver. I think it's time to begin an orderly process of withdrawing our troops, start rebuilding our military, and focusing on the challenges posed by Afghanistan, the global terrorist groups, and other problems that confront America. I understand the very difficult dilemma that any policy with respect to Iraq poses to decision makers. If this were easy, or if there were a very clear way forward, we could all perhaps agree on the facts about how to build toward a resolution that is in the best interest of the United States, that would stabilize Iraq, and would meet our other challenges around the world. With respect to our long-term challenges, Ambassador Crocker, the administration has announced that it will negotiate an agreement with the government of Iraq by the end of July that would provide the legal authorities for U.S. troops to continue to conduct operations in Iraq. Let me ask you, do you anticipate that the Iraqi government would submit such an agreement to the Iraqi parliament for ratification?
The Iraqi government has indicated it will bring the agreement to the Council of Representatives. At this point, it is not clear, at least to me, whether that will be for a formal vote or whether they will repeat the process they used in November with the Declaration of Principles, in which it was simply read to the members of the Parliament.
Does the administration plan to submit this agreement to our Congress?
At this point, Senator, we do not anticipate that the agreements will have within them any elements that would require the advice and consent procedure. We intend to negotiate this as an executive agreement.
Well, Ambassador Crocker, it seems odd, I think, to Americans who are being asked to commit for an indefinite period of time the lives of our young men and women in uniform, the civilian employees, whom you rightly referenced and thanked, as well as billions of dollars of additional taxpayer dollars. If the Iraqi parliament may have a chance to consider this agreement, that the United States Congress would not. And as you may know, I currently have legislation requiring the Congress to have an opportunity to consider such an agreement before it is signed, and I would urge you to submit such an agreement to the Congress for full consideration. General Petraeus, you know, I know that in this March 14th interview with the Washington Post, you stated that no one, and those are your words, no one in the United States and Iraqi governments feels there has been sufficient progress by any means in the area of national reconciliation or in the provision of basic public services. Those are exactly the concerns that my colleagues and I raised when you testified before us in September. I remember well, you know, you're being asked that how long would we continue to commit American lives and treasure if the Iraqis fail to make political gains? And in response, you said that if we reach that point in a year, you'd have to think very hard about it, and it would be difficult to recommend the continuation of this strategy, and there clearly are limits to the blood and treasure we can expend in an effort. Well, we're halfway through the year, and as many of us predicted, and as you yourself stated, we still do not see sufficient progress. What conditions would have to exist for you to recommend to the president that the current strategy is not working? And it seems apparent that you have a conditions-based analysis, as you set forth in your testimony, but the conditions are unclear, they certainly lack specificity, and the decision points with respect to these conditions are also vague. So how are we to judge, General Petraeus, what the conditions are or should be and the actions that you and the administration would recommend pursuing based on them?
First of all, Senator, if I could just comment on the that Washington Post article. What I said was that no one was satisfied with the progress that had been made, either Iraqi or American, but I then went on and actually ticked off a number of the different areas in which there had been progress and talked about the different laws that Ambassador Crocker has rightly identified and a number of other areas in which, in fact, there's been progress, although not satisfactory progress, as I mentioned, in the eyes of either Iraqis or Americans. And so that was the thrust of what I was getting at there, because there has indeed been progress in the political arena, and there actually has been progress in a variety of the other arenas, as Ambassador Crocker laid out in his opening statement. With respect to the conditions, Senator, what we have is a number of factors that we will consider by area as we look at where we can make recommendations for further reductions beyond the reduction of the surge forces that will be complete in July. These factors are fairly clear. There's obviously an enemy situation factor. There's a friendly situation factor with respect to Iraqi forces, local governance, even economic and political dynamics, all of which are considered as the factors in making recommendations on further reductions. Having said that, I have to say that, again, it's not a mathematical exercise. There's not an equation in which you have coefficients in front of each of these factors. It's not as mechanical as that. At the end of the day, it really involves commanders sitting down also with their Iraqi counterparts and leaders in a particular area and assessing where it is that you can reduce your forces so that you can, again, make a recommendation to make further reductions. And that's the process, again. There is this issue, in a sense, this term of battlefield geometry. And as I mentioned, together with Ambassador Crocker and Iraqi political leaders, There's even sort of a political military calculus that you have to consider, again, in establishing where the conditions are met to make further reductions.
If I could just one follow-on question, Mr. Chairman. In response to a question by Senator Levin regarding when you knew of Prime Minister Maliki's plans to go into Basra, you said, and I was struck by it, so I wrote it down, that you learned of it in a meeting where you were planning, where the meeting's purpose was planning to resource operations in Basra on a longer-term basis. And clearly, until relatively recently, southern Iraq has not been within our battlefield geometry. Southern Iraq was originally the responsibility of the British. They have clearly pulled back and were not, so far as I can glean from the press reports, very actively involved in the most recent operations. But what did you mean by the resources you were planning to deploy and over what length of time?
Senator, what we had been working on with the Iraqi National Security Advisor, Ministers of Defense and Interior, was a plan that was being developed by the commander of the Basra Operational Command, General Mohan, which was a fairly deliberate process of laying out, of adding to the resources there on the military side and in other areas. And then there was a phased plan over the course of a number of months during which different actions were going to be pursued. Prime Minister Maliki assessed that that plan was taking too long, determined that the threats that had emerged since provincial Iraqi control in terms of the criminal elements, again, connected to the militia and so forth, were such that more immediate action was taken. And again, as a sovereign country's leader, commander-in-chief of his armed forces, he decided to direct the much more rapid deployment of forces from other locations to Basra. And that is, in fact, what he did, very, very much moving up the timetable and compressing the different activities that, that, in fact, we had been planning to resource over time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clinton. Senator Martinez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Senator Clinton will be followed by Republican Senator Mel Martinez of Florida.
Remark how dramatic a difference it is from today and the reports that you bring us, General Petraeus, from what we had seen when we were last together here in September. I think it's undeniable that dramatic and significant progress have been made, that particularly as it relates to Al-Qaeda, and for that I think you both should be strongly commended, and we thank you. Ambassador Crocker, if I may follow up on the status of force agreement, I would like to just have you explain to the committee, first of all, it is in your prerogative about what course this follows in terms of whether it comes to the Congress or not. Is that not correct?
Senator, it would depend on the elements of the agreement.
And in fact, these are routinely done between the United States and allied countries where we may have forces stationed.
Yes, sir. There are more than 80 of them, and as the chairman noted, only the NATO Status of Forces Agreement has gone before the Senate because of its the special commitments that we undertook in that.
So other than NATO, these do not necessarily or ever come before the Senate. So in other words, it's nothing unusual for this one not to come before the Senate because others do not as well.
That's correct, sir.
Let me ask you, if I may, about the diplomatic interaction with Iran. I know that I continue to be concerned, as I know you are, about their involvement. The December 18th talks have been suspended or postponed. Can you tell us about the status of those potential conversations with Iran going into the future?
Several days ago, the Iraqi Foreign Ministry announced that they were working on arrangements for another round of talks. We have indicated to the Iraqi government previously that we would be prepared to participate in such talks at the request of the Iraqi government, and if in the judgment of the Iraqi government they might possibly improve the security situation. So as it stands now, the government of Iraq is making efforts to see if it can schedule something, and if they can, we'll be there.
But the government of Iran seems to be a little reticent to engage in these talks. Is that what I hear from you?
Yes, sir. We've been through a number of efforts since December, as you point out, and each time something seems to get in the way of the Iranian schedulers.
I know for a long time we talked about the need for us to engage and talk to Iran. I guess it's difficult to talk to someone that doesn't want to talk back or whose actions may not be in good faith. And in that regard, General Petraeus, can you mentioned earlier about 107-millimeter rockets that were being fired upon the international zone in Baghdad. Do we have any idea where the insurgent groups in Iraq are getting these 107-millimeter rockets to fire?
They come from Iran, Senator. As I mentioned, we have found large numbers of them in weapons caches. We recently, in fact, just south of Baghdad, found 45 more in a single weapons cache that also had several thousand pounds of explosives in it. They have come from Iran. There's no question about it. And we have individuals in detention who have explained the entire process that goes on with the special groups, how they are brought over there, how they are recruited, trained, how they are funded, and we've captured, in fact, as I mentioned, one of the senior heads of the special groups and a number of other of their leaders and financiers, all of whom were, again, supported by the Iranian Quds Force. And we, as you know, also have members of the Quds Force in detention.
So they are participating, the Quds Force from Iran is participating in recruitment, training, financing, all but the execution, and I suppose even in some instances maybe the execution of attacks upon our forces as well.
I can't speak to the execution directly. There's clear sense that there has been direction of attacks and of dialing up and dialing down at different times.
Now, we've heard some discussion recently in the media that perhaps Iran had a role in the truce, as it was called, in Basra in recent days. Can you comment on that?
Senator, there has been speculation. I would have to say, honestly, I simply don't know. I think the statement by Muqtada Sadr can be explained in Iraqi terms, just as his original ceasefire announcement in August and its renewal in February were. I think that he and the other members of the Sadr political trend are as aware as anyone that the Jaish al-Mahdi special groups activities politically did not play to their advantage at all. And what we may be seeing through this statement and through some of his subsequent actions and statements is an effort to distance himself from those extremist elements. I think that would make sense. The Sadr movement in its inception touched a deep vein in Iraq. It was populist. It was Iraqi nationalist. It was Arab nationalist. It's kind of lost its moorings somewhat in recent years with this gravitation toward Iran. What we may be seeing now, if you're explaining this in Iraqi terms, is an effort to move away from the Iranian-backed and, I would say, controlled special groups and move back into the Iraqi political forum. I would certainly hope that's the case.
My time is up, but I would like to just close with a comment that some would suggest that we should withdraw troops from Iraq so that we might send them to Afghanistan. I would really prefer to see our NATO partners pick up their share of the load in Afghanistan rather than just shift our troops from one country to another. Thank you both very much. I admire greatly the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Senator Martinez. Senator Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is Senator Mark Pryor, Democrat of Arkansas.
One of your charts, we have it in page 10 of our packet where you show several bar graphs here. And one thing I notice immediately is the national police do not have any operational readiness assessment at level one. And also I notice that with the military, if you look at it, the green, the level one and level two areas have not grown much, maybe a little bit. In fact, it looks like the green maybe is a little smaller and the yellow is a little larger than it was a little over a year ago. I would expect that we would see more progress on the military front in these categories. Why haven't we seen more progress?
There's actually a very simple explanation for that, Senator, and that is that when a unit gets to operational readiness assessment one level, which means that it meets certain goals in terms of personnel fill, leader fill, vehicles, maintenance, training, and a variety of other categories, the Iraqis tend to take leaders from these organizations and use them to form new organizations. And mathematically, then, they just fall below the level that is required to meet the criteria for Operational Readiness Assessment 1. That does not mean that that unit may not be in the lead. The fact that a unit may not have entire fill of its leaders is not at all uncommon in Iraq because there is a shortage of commissioned and non-commissioned officers in particular. That's the toughest part of growing a force as rapidly as they have, is finding qualified commissioned and non-commissioned
officers. Is that how you would recommend to them that they do, that they peel their leaders off of their best units?
I actually think it does make sense, Senator, again, because, again, they're not trying to mathematically get to ORA1. They're trying to get as many units as they can that are reasonably capable. Okay. And I think that is a sensible way to do that. Now, they do have very high-end units that are exceedingly capable, arguably the best counterterrorist forces in the region, certainly the most experienced. I'm not sure, by the way, all of them meet ORA1. Again, they may not meet all the mathematical criteria, but they are certainly extremely good. And they, again, there as well, will take leaders from that to form other new right. elements.
Well, let me ask about another one of your charts. This is the caches found and cleared, which I think is a great chart. Generally, I think that's very good news. However, I do have a question. When you see this big uptick in the number of caches found and cleared, it's great that we're finding them. That's great. But does it also mean that there's just more weapons flooding into Iraq than we've ever seen before?
That may be a factor, but I think the bigger factor, Senator, is that we were in areas where we were not present before. If you look at that chart, you can see there the progression as we cleared certain areas, for example, southeast, southwest of Baghdad, Anbar province, Diyala province, and a number of areas where we had either little presence or no sustained presence, and there was no Iraqi security force presence. And as we have gone into those areas, as we have, in a sense, re-liberated some of these areas from al-Qaeda or other extremist elements, the people have actually told us where these weapons were because they don't want them in their communities.
Well, let me ask about Iran. Iran's come up in several contexts here at this hearing. One of those is providing weapons. We've heard about them providing training, even training trainers who can go in and be insurgents or be terrorists inside Iraq. And Iran should be a concern to all Americans because Iran is not our friend. And if Iran continues to have a great influence in Iraq, we may end up at the end of the day here with an Iraq that is not our friend as well. So I think we need to be very, very careful about Iran. And let me ask about Muqtada al-Sadr. I understand he has very close ties inside Iran. I've read somewhere where he is trying to attain the status of Ayatollah, and he's been doing some study in Iran. I read recently where when the Iraqi government asked him to disband his militias if they wanted to participate in the political process there, he said he would have to talk to clerics, I got the impression those were clerics inside Iraq and inside
in Iraq. In Iraq.
So in Iraq.
Rajai and Ashraf.
And my concern with him, and maybe I'm reading too much into some of these stories I've been reading, but is he trying to set himself up as the future Ayatollah of Iraq?
Senator, virtually the entire year that I've been in Iraq, he has been in Iran. And it's one of the reasons I spoke earlier about some confusion that it seems to me within the Sadr trend as to what it actually stands for and where it's going. He has clearly a very concrete association with Iran now through his presence there and his religious studies in the city of Qom, and then, of course, the Iranian connection to the Jaish al-Mahdi special groups is now undeniable. None of this, as I look at it, contributes at all to the receptivity within Iraq of the Sadr trend. Again, it would seem to me that if he is seeking a future in Iraq, given the roots of this movement, going back to the 90s, as I said, as a populist Iraqi and Arab nationalist movement, he certainly is doesn't seem to be going about it in the right way.
General Petraeus, one last question. My time's up. You've requested that Congress support a supplemental appropriation for Iraq. I will do that, by the way, but hasn't Congress given you everything you've asked and the military everything you've asked for Iraq?
It certainly has, Senator, and I made a point earlier of specifically thanking you for the MRAP vehicles, especially for the ISR and for a number of other cases. With respect to the SERP, it was merely the urgency of having that by June, because that is a hugely important enabler for our commanders and troopers on the battlefield.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pryor.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR News of General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker's testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Iraq, since the surge began and since you last made your presentation to the Congress, there is no question that the situation is better now. It's better than when the surge began.
This is Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi.
In September. It would take a major suspension of disbelief to conclude otherwise, to conclude that things are not much improved. Your testimony has been very measured and honest. According to what we're told, progress is fragile, but it is undeniable, and in large part, I would say, to the efforts of you two gentlemen who've testified today. The question now before this Congress and this country is, do we proceed on with this proven strategy of success? Or, on the other hand, in the face of this demonstrated progress, do we leave with our goals still not yet